Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. So is everybody having a good time? Excellent. My name's Shane Wood. I'm the IT director with the Brewers Association. Our speaker for this session will be Nava Parker, head of laboratory operations for White Labs, presenting Understanding Yeast Flocculations. Nava has been with White Labs since 2002. She earned her bachelor's degree in microbiology from Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, and first became interested in the brewing industry while studying abroad in London. Nava currently manages laboratory operations for the headquarters in San Diego and the R&D facility in Davis, California. She's also responsible for developing the White Labs training and consulting program. She has presented at several workshops and conferences and published articles for brewing magazines. She's an active member of the American Society of Brewing Chemists and Master Brewers Association of the Americas. Please join me in welcoming Nava Parker.
All right. Can everyone hear me okay? Thank you, everyone, for coming. Looks like we'll be a pretty full crowd today, so I appreciate you all being so interested in yeast and flocculation, and I hope you get something out of today's lecture. Just wave at me in the back if you can't hear me or if I step away from the mic or anything. So I'm going to talk to you today about flocculation and hopefully give you a better understanding of the mechanisms behind it and how it works. I'll start off with a little caveat in that a lot of the process of flocculation is really variable, so it's difficult to pinpoint any one thing that might be causing it or not, so it makes it difficult to study. Brewing scientists for the last 10 or 20 years have had difficulty in really figuring out all of the mechanisms. So what I'm going to present today in terms of the information behind it is the widely accepted version of the mechanism, and not confirmed, because it's really difficult to study this process in itself, and you'll see why in a minute. So hopefully today, what we'll be able to take home is some more information about what flocculation is. How does it work? How the mechanisms operate, and some of the theories that scientists have looked to in terms of explaining how all of these pieces fit together. I'll also talk a lot about what affects flocculation. That'll be the biggest portion of it. Some of the impacts to the yeast cell itself and how that affects the way in which the cell flocculates. Some of the environmental impacts, your fermentation medium, the temperatures, pitching rates, things that are outside of the cell but still affect that process itself. And then finally, I'll cover how you can control or improve it. And most of that comes from an understanding of these first two points that I'll cover. But there are some critical control points that I'll try to go over to kind of tie everything together. So there's going to be a lot of theory in here, and I hope I don't bore you to death. But please interrupt me if you have any questions or need clarification as well. So why do we study flocculation in the first place? Why is it important? Why is it important to brewers? There's a lot of reasons, and if you've got flocculation issues, if you have yeast that flocculate early, you're going to have some problems. It's going to sediment out of the beer too quickly. You'll get under attenuation in that case, and also issues with flavor stability. Because the yeast does not remain in contact with the beer, you could get excessive levels of acetaldehyde and diacetyl, which would normally be metabolized by the yeast throughout the fermentation, but it's got to make contact time with those products. There was talk yesterday about diacetyl, and one of the most important points was, making contact with the beer in order to be able to uptake those flavor compounds. So that's really going to have a big effect. If you have yeast that are flocculating out too late, they don't flocculate. Again, there's going to be flavor issues from yeast remaining in suspension and also haze. There's going to be filtering issues. You want the beer to be clear. Now what do you do with it? You've got to figure out a way to get that yeast out of suspension. This also can create a problem with not having enough yeast. if you plan on repitching, you're not going to be able to collect enough yeast. The slurry is going to be really thin, and that's going to create more problems down the line. So it's always important to look at it because it does have an effect on not only the product, but also your process down the road. And, you know, part of the reason that it hasn't been studied as much, brewer's yeast itself, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, has been studied for, you know, centuries by scientists looking at proteins and things like that. But in the laboratory setting, they're usually looking for yeast that don't flocculate because they want the yeast to remain in suspension so that it can work on different mediums that are being used. In brewing, it's the opposite for the most part. You want the yeast to drop out so that it can be removed from beer. So it has only been recently that people are even looking at it in the first place and trying to figure out how that works. So let's talk a little bit about flocculation itself. It's been defined by these two scientists, Stewart and Russell, as the phenomenon where yeast cells adhere in clumps and either sediment rapidly from the medium in which they're suspended or rise to the medium's surface. So it's a couple of different things, and I think that typically when we talk about flocculation, we're talking about the yeast's ability to clump together and drop out at the end of fermentation. But flocculation also applies to top-cropping yeast, or yeast, ale yeast in particular, that will clump together and because of CO2 bubbles from active fermentation will actually rise to the top. So that's also defined as flocculation. What I'll really talk about today is flocculation sediment to the bottom. But just so that we're clear, there are a couple of definitions, and flocculation refers to the rising of clumps as well as the sedimenting of clumps. It's typically a reversible process, so if you can get yeast to flocculate, you can get them to disperse as well. Strain dependent. This is something we always say about almost everything having to do with yeast. It is very strain dependent. Each strain is going to code for different things, so they'll operate slightly differently. And another kind of defining factor is that flocculation, the term, is different than what we consider the chain-forming yeast. For instance, the English ale yeast, yes, we call them very flocculent because they are naturally clumpy. But flocculation in this sense really means the ability of the yeast to drop out. And also I included here wheat beer yeast. Have any of you looked at wheat beer yeast, as a side note, under the microscope and seen what they look like? They form chains together and they look like little men, kind of. No? Okay. Why does flocculation happen, anyways? In nature, it's a really important tool that the yeast use to protect themselves from stress. In a beer fermentation, it's mainly ethanol stress. So they'll, you know, pack together, and the cells that are in the inside are well protected. So those outside cells are kind of sacrificing themselves in order to protect the population as a whole. The problem with this is that it results in a limited growth because there's not a lot of nutrient transfer to the cells on the inside. So it's not something that they would do throughout the fermentation process when there's a lot of nutrients available, but when the stress level gets high enough, so when the alcohol rises, that's when you start getting these clumps starting to form because it's just a stress response that the yeast are using in order to protect themselves. So a little more about flocculation. We really need to look at the yeast cell membrane. This is where all of the activity happens in terms of flocculation and how it happens. So you can see that the cell membrane itself is composed of a lot of really intricate pieces. There's a lot of things going on here. And not only do we have that, you can see on the bottom of the picture here, that's the inside of the cell. The top part is the outside, and there's also going to be another layer, which is the cell wall, that kind of crosses over this. But all these little protrusions you have at the top are coming out of the membrane and also through the cell wall. So there's a lot of interactions with all of the fluid outside of the cell while it's still protecting itself. But some of the important things to point out from this diagram are here when we're talking about flocculation. The glycoproteins and carbohydrates that are associated with the cell wall. So here, for instance, would be the cell wall itself, kind of dividing, protecting the membrane from the extracellular fluid, but some of these arms that are kind of coming up will come through that cell wall in order to interact with things on the outside. Genetic theories behind flocculation, why does it happen, how does it happen, you know, what is the right pathway? There's a lot of things. You may have seen some of these referenced in different papers and research. The calcium bridge, which is a theory that calcium creates a bridge from one cell to the other, allowing them to connect. Zymolectin binding. Zymolectins I'll talk about in a minute, so I won't go into too much detail right now. Hydrophobic interactions, surface charge neutralization, and influences of flow, which is a gene. Again, I'll talk about that in more detail. So which one of these is right? What's been accepted? You know, as I kind of said at the beginning, it's difficult to say exactly because it is so variable, and there's a lot of bits and pieces. So really, it's almost all of these working together. Because the mechanism itself is so complex, a lot of this is still theory. It's based on trial and error and determining that these components do have an effect on the cell's ability to flocculate, but how that exactly works is still yet to be determined. So these are accepted, and these are the most accepted, widely accepted in the industry. And a lot of these factors are working together in order to promote or prevent flocculation. So before I go on, I'm going to give you a few definitions so that you can kind of follow what I'm talking about here. FLO1, I kind of mentioned a second ago. It's a gene that's found within the yeast cell DNA that scientists have discovered controls the synthesis of certain proteins. Now, it's been accepted that most of the proteins that they are making are called lectin or lectin-like proteins, and they're called zymolectins, and that's on the next page. Mannose. Mannose is an important sugar that's found in wort, and it's really important to this process, so that's why I've included it here. Mannan or mannan receptors. It's a polysaccharide, which just means it's multiple sugars, multiple carbohydrates that are in a linear chain. So these are mannose sugars that are in a chain together. Lectins, these are a little bit longer. Really the important one that I want to point out is the zymolectins. That's what we're going to be really focusing on here. It's defined as any protein or glycoprotein structures associated with the yeast cell wall, which contains specific carbohydrate binding domains whose presence causes or enhances cell flocculation. So if I go back to this picture really quickly, the circle on the left, the glycoproteins, those are what we're looking at. Those are the zymolectins that we're talking about. These will extend outside of the yeast cell wall, and those are the ones that will have the specific binding sites for receptors, which are sugar-based, that will cause the flocculation to happen. So to give you a better illustration here, a diagram of the yeast cell wall. The little Y-shaped things are the zymolectins, mannan receptors, those long-chain sugars that are found on the surface of the cell wall, are the little teardrop shapes. And so you've got two yeast cells here, and what normally happens when the flocculation is occurring is that you'll get cells coming together and binding. So it's sort of like a puzzle. You know, you can't just fit any puzzle piece together because they won't fit. They're very specific. And it's the same thing here. These zymolectin proteins are, you know, very specific and will only accept these mannan receptors because they're the right shape. Does that make sense to everyone so far? All right. So the role of flow. I mentioned flow a couple of times, and it's a gene. it's really important to part of the study because it does control the making of those imelectin compounds. Different strains will use different flow type genes. There are many that have been found on the yeast DNA. Flow 1 is the most common, but there's, you know, flow 5, 8, new flow. And each one codes for a different protein compound, a different zymolectin that is specific. So that's kind of where we get the differentiation across strains. Some strains will have a different zymolectin than another, and they will not be able to bind together. Others will be controlled by the same flow gene, which means that you can put two different strains together, and they will co-flocculate. So, you know, that's a possibility. But it's an important gene because it controls a lot of these mechanisms. So as far as what can affect flocculation itself, there's a lot of different things. You know, I've always kind of already kind of mentioned that, but these are some of the cellular functions that affect the mechanisms themselves. One of the bigger ones is cell surface charge, the charge that's on the outside of the cell itself. Yeast cells are normally negatively charged, which means because of some of these protrusions that are on the cell wall, they all have a certain charge on them. And yeast cells have a lot of carboxyl groups, phosphate groups, and those are all negatively charged. So that makes the outside of the cell negative. So if you get two negative charges together, they're not really going to stick together. It's sort of like opposite ends of a magnet. It's going to repel one another. So in a normal surface charge for yeast, you've got a lot of negatives all around the cell. And you've got another cell which also has a lot of negatives around it. And those are really not going to have the ability to bind together and flocculate. Oops. So, again, it's sort of like opposite poles of a magnet. They're going to repel each other, so they'll stay apart. And you won't get any interaction between these two cells. On the other hand, if you can neutralize the charge on the yeast, those negative charges go away. So now the cells can interact. So a lot of this is dependent on pH values, other compounds that are in the wort that could possibly bind with some of these carboxyl groups or phosphate groups that are on the cell to render them neutral. Another important facet of this, and these two sort of go together, is cell surface hydrophobicity. And hydrophobic really just means the extent to which the cell surface can repel water. So if the yeast has low hydrophobicity, that means it can't repel water very well. So water will bind to the cell wall. And the opposite, if you increase the hydrophobicity of the cell, more hydrophobic, then it'll continue to repel these water bonds, so it won't be bonded to the cell wall. To illustrate this a little bit so it makes a little more sense, decreased hydrophobicity, which means the yeast has a low tendency to repel water molecules. The water molecules will naturally be attracted to the cell surface, because we've already know that it's negatively charged. So if we put these cells together and they're less hydrophobic, again, what's going to happen? There's no interaction between the two cells because they're repelling each other, right? I worked really hard on that. but if you can increase the hydrophobicity of the cell, which means now you can repel more of that water, you can get some binding sites here that are available and open so the cells can now interact with each other. You may still get, you know, some water molecules surrounding, but there won't be so many that the cells can't interact. So that's a really important aspect to remember here. So in terms of hydrophobic interactions, when does this happen? Why does it happen? It's been found that yeast will reach their maximum flocculation potential after 24 hours. So you've got yeast in fermentation. It's been 24 hours. This is when they're at the height of their potential to flocculate. All of the pieces are kind of just right. The hydrophobicity is very high at this point. So they're repelling a lot of water, which means they can interact with each other. So why don't they flocculate out right now after 24 hours? Most of that has to do with sugars that are still present. Sugars will inhibit a cell's ability to interact together, and I'll show you why in a second. So that's sort of the reason we get this interaction happening. Multiple components are involved here. So while the yeast is ready to flocculate at 24 hours, it's not able to. Another factor that really affects it is the age of the yeast itself and the number of budding cycles, so the number of times it's grown. How many generations has it gone? Normally, mother cells have better flocculation properties than daughter cells, and the prime for yeast has been found to be 2 to 3 generations, even fourth generation yeast, because they've undergone some of these processes where they are very highly hydrophobic. They've got, good charges. So they're able to flocculate. They're used to this medium now, and their cell wall has reacted in such a way where they're prepared for this flocculation. Daughter cells, which are brand new, have to kind of learn the process and also get adapted to the environment. So their cell walls are not as prepared. So after a couple of buds, it increases. But after that, you start to get decrease. As the cells get older, they start losing their flocculation properties because now, they've created too many buds. And again, you've got on the left, a very old yeast cell that has, gone through multiple budding cycles versus a newer cell that has maybe gone through one budding cycle. And you can see the surface of the cell here. And, we're talking about these proteins that are having to come out of the cell wall in order to bind together. And now on the older cell, we have less and less surface area in which these proteins can be associated with the cell walls and actually bind. So that's where we start to get our decrease, our decline in flocculation potential. Moving on to environmental factors. A lot of different things, again, will react with the yeast and will have an effect on how the cell wall can perform, how it can, react in this situation. The temperature has a lot to do with it, and pitch rate. Those two factors mainly have to do with having active fermentations, and I'll explain that in a minute as well and why that's important. But I'm not going to talk in too much detail about those two. As you increase temperature, you're going to increase yeast activity. As you get better yeast activity, you'll get potentially better flocculation properties. Pitch rate, the same thing. If you overpitch, you have a tendency to grow less yeast. So with less growth, you also get less activity, and the potential for flocculation is going to decrease as well. So pitching at a lower rate, or at least at the correct amount, is really where you want to be in terms of getting correct flocculation properties. The fermentation medium has a lot to do with it, and that's, the wort. Mineral content of the wort, specifically calcium in this case, the pH, nutrition, presence of inhibitory sugars. All of those things I've kind of mentioned, and I'll talk more detail about them now. And then fermenter turbulence has a lot to do with it as well. So all of these factors, I want to point out, will affect the cellular interactions, and that's why they're so important. But I'm going to concentrate on these factors here and go into a bit more detail about them. So fermentation medium, your wort. Metal content of the wort is important. Aside from, nutrition, sugars, oxygen, things like that that yeast need, which is sort of a given, the metal content, specifically calcium, is critical in this process. The zymolectins And the binding of zymolectins with the mannan receptors is dependent on calcium. It acts as a cofactor to promote this binding. So if calcium is not there, we're not going to be able to get binding to occur. So to further illustrate this point, you can see, again, the yeast cell, the Ys are the zymolectins, and the teardrop shapes are the mannan receptors. So you can kind of see here, without calcium, it can't bind because the shape's a little bit different. They can't fit together. And that's a result of not having that cofactor, which is going to cause the zymolectin receptors, once they're bound to calcium, to look more like this, for instance. So now we get our mannan receptors, and they're able to fit in there now. And that's because of calcium. And calcium has, you know, a pretty big effect on this process, and it can be affected by other ions that are in solution. Having too many salts, sodium, potassium, and things like that can affect the zymolectin's ability to bind with calcium and promote this process. So there are some factors as well that will come into play in making sure that the calcium levels are there. So, again, calcium, very important. Nutrition, specifically in this case, nitrogen and magnesium. If you limit the amount of nutrient that's available to the yeast, you can increase the flocculation properties, which can be good if you have yeast that aren't flocculating well, but it can be bad if you have yeast that are going to drop out too early. If they're limited in nutrients, they don't have that available anymore, and they'll start to drop out of solution. They'll start to bind together very quickly, and they'll drop out. So a couple of things to remember there. You just want to make sure those dosages are right. And nitrogen, in most cases, is in the form of free amino nitrogen, amino acids. And as far as the levels you want to reach in your wort with that, you want to hit around 150 parts per million of nitrogen. Magnesium is a little bit harder because it's a trace element, which means there's not a lot of it present. There's not a lot that is needed by the yeast, but it does have to be there. If you find that nutrition is an issue, you can add back magnesium in the form of magnesium salts, magnesium chloride. And that's at a rate of about 1 gram per liter of magnesium chloride. pH. pH has a very big effect on the cell in terms of hydrophobicity and charges, cell surface charge. This is because the hydrogen ions that act are positively charged. So it can change some of those. It can neutralize some of the things. But you want to work within an optimal pH range. This one's sort of difficult because I've read varying reports on what is optimal in terms of pH. Anything below 5.3, so between 3.5 and 5.3, it can sort of be a broad range. Some of that has to do with the effects of other things within the medium itself or within the beer itself. Ethanol has an effect on how sensitive the zymolectins are to pH change. So if you have more ethanol in solution, high-gravity beer or something, the proteins will work over a wider pH range. So you may get yeast dropping out quickly or too early in a high-gravity beer because you've got more ethanol present, and that affects how the proteins will react to pH changes. So it'll operate over a wider range instead of a very narrow range. So that could cause early flocculation. But typically, you want to make sure that 4.5 is where you're sitting in terms of pH. That's the most optimal range. And luckily, most beer is 4.4, 4.5 at the end of fermentation anyways. And that's at the point when you want to see yeast starting to drop out. But it's a good way to check your process and see if, you know, you're higher or lower than that. Especially if you are noticing that you're having flocculation problems. That could be a sign. Inhibitory sugars. This I've kind of glazed over, but it is an important part of this as well. Specifically mannose and mannose derivatives, which are could be mannose sugars that are connected to carboxyl groups or mannose sugars connected to phosphates. But it's basically mannose. It competes with binding sites on zymolectin. We already know from the beginning and the definitions that mannan receptor is on the yeast cell wall, which causes the flocculation, are long chains of mannose sugars. So if there's a lot of mannose still present in the wort itself, it can actually compete with those mannan receptors for binding on the zymolectins. So, for instance, you see here, they're a very similar shape to our receptors, and they're present in the wort. So if they're binding, then we can't get binding from the other yeast cell because there's no openings available here for them to be attracted to each other. So when I was talking earlier about cell hydrophobicity and how it reaches that maximum level after 24 hours, but the inhibitory sugars are present, this is what's happening. These mannose sugars are still present in the wort, preventing any binding from occurring, so you're not getting flocculation at that point because there's sugars there. So until the yeast metabolizes those sugars, it's not possible to have that flocculation occurring. So the timing is really important. And it's interesting that, you know, we do see that in nature. Yeast are not going to flocculate out at 24 hours. It's going to continue to ferment because those sugars are there. So they'll continue to bind. They'll also metabolize. And as those sugars start to decrease, we start to see cells now starting to flocculate more. Turbulence, fermenter turbulence. There's a lot of kind of terms for this, for what it can be called, flow of the fermentation within the fermenter itself, shear. But basically, it's movement within the fermenter. So fermenter design is important. The height of it is important because getting all that movement throughout the fermentation is really important. It's necessary for the yeast cells to make contact with one another. So agitation in there is going to be a key point here. And it's going to depend a lot on the fermenter itself. The fermenter height is going to have a lot to do with it. These taller fermenters are going to provide a little bit more current than shorter fermenters. But also the rate of sugar consumption and CO2 production. So the reason we get all this movement within the fermenter is that yeast are active, which is why the yeast activity part is so key. They're producing a lot of CO2, and the CO2 is causing a lot of this movement, as well as heat and things like that as well. But the CO2 is really going to cause all this movement. It causes yeast to rise at the beginning of fermentation, right, in these flocks that rise to the top. So if the yeast are consuming sugar faster, they're producing more CO2. And more CO2 is going to create more agitation within the fermenter, which is good. So we want to maintain this really active fermentation and a pretty quick rate of consumption of sugar because we need to maintain all of this movement. The one thing to take note of here, though, is that excessive agitation or excessive shear can reduce flocculation. It can actually strip off some of those proteins that are on the outside of the cell. And this is not, you know, through fermentation, but if you're pumping the yeast or, you know, doing something else to transfer it in a pretty rough environment, that can have a big effect on it. That's not very commonly done, but something to remember. So, for instance, you know, we've got some yeast here sitting in suspension. In a laboratory setting, perhaps, this is something that you would see. The yeast are just kind of there in the media, and they're not really moving around. Because brewer's yeast is non-motile, they have no way to move about on their own. They don't move. So they're relying on other factors to allow them to, you know, to make interactions, to move around. So when you've got shear or good flow agitation, you've got all these cells in the wort that are moving around and bumping into each other. And because they're coming in close contact, they can actually interact. And that's the only way we're going to get this flocculation really to get promoted. Otherwise, you're going to have yeast just sitting there and not really coming into contact with each other. If they're not doing that, it's not really possible for them to you know, bind together and flocculate. So this is really important to make sure that We're getting a lot of movement. The yeast are moving around, and they're bumping into each other, and they're making contact. So now they are capable of binding and flocculating, as long as the other factors, the influential factors, are there and available. So, control mechanisms. Any questions so far? Yes, in the back. Are you talking about this diagram? This one? How many of the sugar bonds are actually occurring? It really depends on the number of sugar molecules that are present. That's going to be the deciding factor, really. So if there's a lot of zymolectin proteins on the cell wall surface, and there's only a few mannose floating around, then of course they're only going to bind a few. But it will, as long as they're coming into contact with each other, they will bind. Because of this procedure, they preferentially will make this sugar binding. But if you're getting yeast into close contact with each other, it's possible that you'll get some of the mannose receptors binding instead. But as long as those sugars are there, they're going to preferentially bind because it's easier for them. How many on each cell? Mm-hmm. In order to create the flocculation? That I'm not sure of, and I haven't run across anything in literature that really details how many binding sites are necessary for the flocculation to happen. I think some of that is going to depend on how many sites there are and how many are in close contact across the two cells. If you've got, they've got to fit pretty closely. So if you've got one receptor or one zymolectin here and, two mannan receptors here, and there's not another zymolectin, it could just be one. It could be multiple if they're in line with each other. So I think it just really depends on the structure of the cell wall itself and how many are capable of coming into contact with each other. But I imagine it could be as few as one binding site, and flocculation can occur. But you're going to get, multiple cells binding with each other. It's not going to be just two cells. It's going to be aggregates of cells. So each cell is going to have, as many yeast as it can fit around it, binding, with it. And then, those are going to have multiple ones all around them too. So the drawings are very simplistic, obviously, because I'm not a professional graphics animation person, but if we had a 3D model or something like that, I think it would make more sense because you're going to get flocks and yeast cells all over that are going to bind at these sites. So in that case, you have multiple interactions. Are there multiple interactions between one cell and another? I don't know, but one cell with many cells, there will be a lot of interactions. Does that kind of answer your question? Okay. Anything else before I move on a little bit? Okay. So, we've done a lot of kind of theory mechanism. This is how it works. These are the contributing factors. But I want to tie it all together so that you can take the information that I just threw at you here and kind of understand how this has a practical use. So I'm going to talk now just about control mechanisms, some of the flocculation issues that might occur, what the causes might be, and what you can do. So early flocculation. Excuse me. It could have multiple causes. I've kind of touched on some things here and there throughout. Poor fermentation is going to have a lot to do with it. I already mentioned about the agitation, and where does most of the agitation come from? CO2 production. CO2 production comes from an active fermentation. The yeast is taking up a lot of sugars really quickly and producing a lot of CO2. So if you have a poor fermentation, there's not going to be a lot of movements within the fermentation itself. So the yeast are going to start to turn on these receptors and start to bind with each other and drop out. Again, that relates to the turbulence in the fermenter. Premature yeast flocculation. Try to say that 10 times fast. Have you guys heard of this kind of phenomenon before, talked about before? Most of it occurs from poor quality malts. There's been a mold that's associated with poor quality malt that causes the yeast to turn on these binding sites and flocculate early. So that's something to keep in mind. It has happened to people in the past, but another resource. If it's something that you can't determine from these other issues, it could be the malt itself. Nutrient limitations. I talked about that with the nitrogen and magnesium. If you're nutrient poor in your wort, that's going to cause the yeast to start flocculating very quickly. So making sure that you have enough nitrogen within the wort itself. And, you know, when you're doing all malt brewing, nitrogen itself is not typically an issue because you'll get enough out of barley malt already. But if you are using other sources, rye, corn, adjuncts, rice, extract, you do want to look at those free amino nitrogen levels because they can be less. Also, if you're doing high-gravity brewing, it's really important to make sure that you maintain those nitrogen levels because that can be diluted with the amount of sugars that you're extracting from the malt. So those are kind of the two factors you want to look at when in terms of nitrogen. High-gravity brewing, and are you using anything other than malted barley? Magnesium, I also mentioned too. And just to reiterate, on the nitrogen, you want to be at about 150 parts per million of nitrogen. Magnesium, if you're low or if you're having problems with flocculation and it's something you want to try to do, you can add back some magnesium at a rate of about 1 gram per liter. The other thing is mutations in the yeast itself. It can happen. Because we're talking about several different genes coding for a lot of different things, we've got flow genes that are coding for zymolectins, we've got, you know, the ones that are coding for the mannan receptors, and all these other facets that are going to have an effect on the yeast, the mutations can actually occur really rapidly as far as the ones that contribute to flocculation changes. And it happens a lot faster than you would see mutations for, you know, differences in flavor compound, like the way the yeast produce flavor compounds. Those kind of mutations you see very rarely, but the flocculation ones can happen really quickly because of the variability and because of all the factors that are involved. And I always like to tell people, too, that once you start to see flocculation changes over many generations, it's time to switch yeast. Because of all the stress and the potential for changes, when you start to see flocculation occur differently than you normally would, it's a sign that something's happened with your yeast culture, that it's different than it was. So, major sign of mutation. What can you do? If you have early flocculation happening, you know, some of these things are occurring, what can you do now to try to get that yeast to either flocculate out or get back in suspension? In this case, get back in suspension. First thing that you can do, the easiest thing that you can do right off the bat, is try to rouse the yeast and get the active fermentation going again. It can be hard to do, but a nice CO2 shot will usually do the trick, and raising the temperature a little bit. So at this point, we want to just try to get yeast active again. You can try to add new yeast if this process doesn't work, or Croizen if you've got another active fermentation going. Try to get that in there and get done, because, you know, at this point, you just want to get the beer finished. Got to attenuate, because we're going to have low attenuation, possibly diacetyl and other off-flavor compounds. So we want to make sure that we are addressing the immediate issue first. Later down the line, if these steps don't work, I'm trying to add back some nitrogen or magnesium in the form of nutrients. And I've already said that the amounts that you want to be shooting for. But that is a possibility. I don't usually recommend that unless you have to, because it is difficult to go into a fermentation that's already going and add, you know, some powdered nutrient. You have to be careful with your handling and, you know, getting that mixed in with the fermentation very well so that the yeast, all the yeast, have access to it. The other thing that you can do is do a forced fermentation. If the yeast is dropped out, nothing else seems to be working, maybe there are no sugars, fermentable sugars, left in the beer. So you want to make sure of that before you take some further steps. Forced fermentation is a good way to do that. Pull off a small sample, you inoculate it with, you know, 10 times the amount of yeast that you would for normal pitching, and you'll get a quick fermentation. That yeast will finish out very quickly. You'll get a final gravity, so you can compare that with what you already have. If it's stopping and stuck, then, you know, there's no more fermentables. If it continues to go, then it's possible to get this fermentation going again. So you want to make sure that you look at all the options before you take any, you know, really drastic measures as far as how to control that part. So that's post-fermentation. You've already got the problem. What are you going to do? Preventative. How do we prevent these from happening? Having some internal standards for malt quality and ways to test for it. I talked about, you know, that premature yeast flocculation and the poor malt quality. It's just really important to look at all of your raw ingredients as they come in and make sure that you've got, you know, a really critical eye and that quality is consistent, because, you know, you shouldn't demand any less. So that is going to be key in this procedure as well. Be familiar with your yeast and the way it behaves. That way, if there are problems, you can identify them early. But you want to make sure that you understand the flocculation. You don't want to wait until it's too late, because now you may have to go back and, you know, do something really drastic in order to get this beer to finish out. Maintaining the proper pH throughout fermentation. Now, I give a range here of 3.5 to 5.3. And I already said that optimal is 4.5. But this gives you a little bit of a range to work with. But if you do see your pH either dropping below 4.5 or above 4.5, that may be an indication that there could be an issue with flocculation. So monitor that very closely. And then maintaining proper levels of nutrients. I can't say that enough, because these all contribute in small ways to the way these operate and how healthy they are and how these functions are all going to work together. So nutrition is going to be key here as well. What about the opposite? Little flocculation or no flocculation at all? Potential causes: old yeast populations. You know, I already said before about all the bud scars that could be on the yeast. That could cause the yeast to not drop out because now they don't have binding sites. Mutations in the yeast culture, that's induced by stress. Again, I already mentioned all the possible mutations that occur. And mutated yeast are what we call petite mutants. And they tend to have a really increased negative charge, which means they'll just repel each other, and the hydrophobicity is decreased. So they will not bind together. And that is just a property of their cell walls because they are mutations. So that's why you see those just remaining in suspension. Inhibitory compounds in the wort, mannose sugars, I mentioned that. That's going to have a huge effect on it. So if there are a lot of these sugars present, you're not going to get flocculation. And then deficiency in metal ions, specifically calcium. And this is one that's talked about a lot. Calcium is important to binding. We can't get that binding occurring unless there's enough calcium present. And again, it's going to be very trace amounts. So what can you do if you have little or no flocculation? Post-fermentation, try to crash cool the beer down to 32 if you can. This will sometimes encourage the yeast to become dormant and start to drop out on its own. This is the first step. So you can try it. If that part doesn't work, a fining agent, isinglass, I know a lot of people don't want to use it. It doesn't smell very good, but it works. And it works by attracting yeast because of the charges. They have opposite charges, so they will bind together. And that's why they work. And isinglass is specifically for pulling out yeast, and it works very well. Filtration. If you have a filter and you can do it, this is something you might have to do. Centrifugation. All of these things are possible. Are they great? Do you want to do them? Are you able to do them? You know, it's a little bit harder to go down that route, but it can be done. Induced co-flocculation. This is one I didn't really talk about at all, and it's not really confirmed, but there have been studies that have shown that if you put yeast that are very flocculent in with yeast that haven't flocculated, the flocculent yeast can actually turn on receptors that can bind to the non-flocculent yeast and help them drop out of solution. So I think that's something that could be interesting to look at down the road and see if and how it works, because it could be a really easy solution to some of these other things. More to come on that. But preventative, which is going to be a lot easier to do upstream. Ensuring active fermentation. Again, same as with early flocculation, the active fermentation part is important. Maintaining proper calcium levels. Get your water profiled. A lot of times I've seen city water change, and you know, if you're using city water, you may not know that things have changed or sources have changed, so those calcium levels could be different. You need a very small amount. On your reports, I think that you'll see it in this language, 0.1 millimolars. But that basically equates to this. If you have to add back calcium to try to get the yeast to flock out, calcium chloride is what you would want to use, and it's at about 1.1 grams per liter of calcium chloride. And again, keeping a close eye on your yeast and maintaining a population of young cells. And proper pH levels, and reducing excessive shear to yeast. Some of this is pretty similar to you know, early flocculation. It's just maintaining these optimal conditions for the yeast. So in closing, and to kind of summarize everything I've talked about today, you want to understand these reasons as best as you can. I know there's a lot of interactions happening here, and it's not possible to understand everything, but these all work together, and you know, try to control them as much as you can based on your understanding. These three main principles are what I hope you will take from this. Calcium is required for flocculation to happen. It can be inhibited by sugars present, inhibitory sugars, mannose, and initiation requires agitation of cells. So strong fermentation, a lot of movement, so that the cells can come in contact with each other. These three key roles are going to ensure that you will have the most successful flocculation rate as possible. And prevention will give you the highest success rate. You could see that some of the post-fermentation things you would want to do can be kind of hard. So trying to prevent any issues from occurring is really going to you know, give you the best rate of success. In terms of getting the flocculation that you need. Oh, so with that, I'm finished. If you have questions, I'll take them now, or my email address is here if you'd like to email them to me. But thank you for listening. Over there? Yes. Calcium sulfate would work as well. Calcium chloride is usually the easiest and most available, but you can do calcium sulfate. It might be, I would have to check, it might be a different dosage rate, but if it is, it's pretty minimal. A lot of these salts, regardless of if it's chloride or sulfate, are going to overdose what you need because some of it just doesn't become unbound for the yeast to use anyways. So you should be okay using close to the same dosage rate with calcium sulfate. Mm-hmm. Question over here. Yes. Thank you. The question was about zinc and its effect on flocculation. There's not a direct correlation with zinc and flocculation itself, but the importance of zinc has to do with some of the metabolic processes of the yeast. So it's important in terms of making sure fermentation is active, because, again, if you don't have an active fermentation, you won't get agitation, and that's really what we're looking for. So a lot of the things that contribute to yeast health and, good fermentation performance are going to have an effect on the flocculation properties at the end. Thanks. Yes. So the question was about this co-flocculation, and I haven't actually done it or looked at it myself. The problem is that you can't just throw any yeast with any other yeast because they may not have the same protein interactions. But I think that it is a potential solution, and I would have to look at it more. But I read it somewhere, and then I thought it might be interesting to see because, yeah, some of these yeasts that really don't like to drop out, and that's just a character of that yeast. You know, Saison yeast will not drop out. That's the way they are. That's the way their gene pool works. But can you get it to flocculate in natural ways without adding, Isinglass or filtering or doing any of these things? So I don't know for a fact that it works, but in theory, it should. So I'm going to do it and see. The flow genes, yes. And it really is going to be, whether or not the two strains that you use are expressing the same flow gene. Because if they are, then yes, it could definitely work. But you would have to get them genetically mapped so that you know if they're, flow 1, if one's flow 1 and one's flow 8, they're not going to work together. But if they're both flow 1, it could happen. No. But it's more work than we have to do. I think it would be good work. Yes.
Have you guys done any...
I can hear you up here.
Have you done any work on top pressure on the tank to help push?
Top pressure? I haven't done any work on top pressure. So I'm not sure how that works exactly. I think that a little more pressure applied can actually cause these to flocculate better. But I can't confirm that. Yes, I think you had your hand up first. Sure. For some of the strains that don't flock, why don't they? It really has to do with the receptors. So the genes that are coding for these certain proteins, there's either less of them on some of those strains, or they don't protrude out of the cell wall as much, so it's harder for them to bind with other cells. So really it goes back to just genes and how those proteins are being made that will cause the flocculation to happen. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't add oxygen late in fermentation, but if it's early on, then there's really not a difference. So that's kind of the only reason I recommended CO2 is if it does occur late, you don't want to introduce oxygen. Mm-hmm. Yes. Brewing ingredients and higher levels of mannose? Oh, like some of the procedures? I don't, and most of the time I think when you're breaking down some of those starches, they're going to break down into those components. It's generally very similar across the board. Some ingredients may have more or less than others, but if you're predominantly malt, it's going to be pretty consistent across the board. And I don't have that percentage of mannose, I'm sorry. Yes. How would you get the yeast to stay in suspension? We'll do the opposite of these things. Okay. Really, it's going to be yeast strain. It's going to be some of these things that are available. It's harder unless you can just get it moving to stay in suspension, or if there's some sugars and there's active fermentation happening. The other thing you can do is try to select for yeast that will stay in suspension. You could try raising the pH. I don't know if that would help them stay in suspension. One thing you can do to break up some of the flocks is add a buffer, like EDTA or something like that, because that will break up the yeast so they won't clump together. And that might help them stay in suspension longer. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, in the back. Using too much. There can be, so you want to try to get as close to the right level as you can. It's because some of those interactions, for instance, if you added too much magnesium to the wort, that could affect the binding of calcium to the zymolectins. So it can potentially have an inverse effect. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah, it's definitely possible to add too much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Well, and that's a difficulty a lot of times with some of these things, because there's such trace amounts. When you tell people to add, 2 parts per million of something, I mean, it's a pinch in a 10-barrel fermentation. So that does make it harder. But you can, and depending on the nutrient, you can overdose it. But nitrogen is another one that you don't want to add too much of, because it can have adverse effects just in flavor compound production. Sure. One more. Yes. A lot of simple sugars. It can, until the yeast will metabolize those sugars. The problem with those simple sugars is that they are, glucose, fructose, sucrose, potentially mannose, which can inhibit it. But, if the metabolism is occurring properly and the yeast is metabolizing those, once it's finished with that, it should start to drop out. But it can have an effect if it's staying in solution, because they'll preferentially take in those sugars depending on how small they are. All right. Thank you. If anyone else has any questions, you can send me an email or I'll be around.